I feel very honored and privileged to be here today. So thank you so much for the hearty and warm welcome I received, of course, yesterday and then today again. So thank you very much for that. Well, this is really my first time in the West, I think, teaching in a Dharma center. Well, unless Tibet House in New York counts. I'm not sure it's a Dharma center. But anyway, so I feel extremely honored and very happy. And so I would like to talk about debate today. I understand there's a mixture of different understandings, I guess, different levels. So I hope I'll be able to address everyone's needs and everyone's understanding. So I don't want to be too technical, but I also don't want to be going, you know, be too general. So I'll try to find a balance. And your questions, your inputs would be very helpful for doing that. Okay. So many of you, can you raise your hands? Those of you who have already studied debate, could I have a... Okay, those of you who studied debate before, great. Okay. Okay, so there are some. So I want to address the needs of those who studied already. Did you study already? You? No. Okay. All right, so I'll say something more in general about this technique. Now, it's important that this is only a technique, a tool. Is this the only way to practice the Dharma? Of course not. Is this the best way to study the Dharma? Again, who can say? For some people, it's very beneficial. It's a great tool, a very beneficial tool, maybe the best tool for the time being. For others, it may be less helpful. So this is something everyone individually needs to explore, how helpful they find that. And of course, Dharma practice, like anything, for anything to come together, to have a result, whatever that result may be, being a better person, being entering the Mahayana path, becoming a, you know, an arhat, a bodhisattva, a Buddha, all this needs so many causes and conditions. So many different causes and conditions need to come together. So this is just one cause. This is just one tool that helps to understand the Dharma better. But that is an important part to gain a good understanding of the Dharma. And it's been stressed by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I mean, traveling around, one thing His Holiness always says, study. Study is so important. And a lot of people have this idea, Buddhism is just about meditation. Of course, it is about meditation. But how can we meditate on something if we don't know on what? If we sit there and have all these questions and all these doubts, and how can we really meditate? And one of my teachers, years ago, he once gave me this explanation. He's a great Geshe, he's a great practitioner. And he said, actually, debate is a type of meditation. If you allow it to become a kind of meditation, it's a kind of analytical meditation. So just briefly, there are two types of meditation, if you like. Meditations can be categorized into stabilizing meditation, and many of you know that. Stabilizing meditation, where you just focus on one object to stabilize the mind, to calm the mind, to make it more focused. That is the one type of meditation. So you would maybe focus on the breathing in and out. You would focus on an image of the Buddha. You would focus on one specific object, maybe the sensations in your body, just being in the moment, being mindful. That very much focuses the mind. It calms it down. That is one type of meditation. But then there's another type where you analyze, where you examine, where you investigate. Why would you do that? Well, in everyday kind of life, if you think, if you try to bring to mind, last time you got angry, last time a strong emotion arose, positive or negative, love, compassion, or anger, jealousy, hatred, attachment, they never arise without a reason. It seems to arise without a reason, but it's usually, well, so-and-so said such-and-such. Right, we rationalize. Oh, they did say that to me. I was very kind to them. But, you know, this is how they repay my kindness. Or how dare they say those things. How embarrassing, right? Or, oh, this person is so wonderful. It looked like Brad Pitt or, you know, Angelina Jolie or whoever, you know, someone. So, oh, this is the kind of person I want to be. So there's always a reason. So we use reasons all the time. They're not correct reasons. I'm not saying they're based on reality. But nonetheless, our mind is always working. I like this. I don't like this. Judging, right? Analyzing to some degree. So it comes natural. And then what does it, what happens? We bring it to an emotional level, right? Then, oh, this and this, they said so and so and so and so. And the more we analyze, the more, the angrier we get, right? I'm a little angry today, but tomorrow is already more and more. Anyway, so you see there is a connection between the rational mind, which we wouldn't really call that rational if it's like totally, you know, not in accordance with reality. But there's this part of our mind, part of our brain, can't really talk of them separately, that rationalizes and uses reasoning, and then that's taken to an emotional level. So the Buddha, understanding that very basic psychological makeup, that we all, as human beings, we work that way, right? From our own experience, we know it works that way. Right, we constantly keep checking and analyzing. Well, using that as the basis, now you try to replace our often, you know, our mistaken reasoning, which then leads us to have leads to the arisal of negative emotions such as like anger, hatred, aggression, jealousy, and so forth. Now we try to replace it with reasoning that is in accordance with reality. And allow positive states to arise. Allow love, compassion to arise. Because these states are based on reality. Right? It doesn't make sense to be angry and hateful if we're all interconnected and we're all the same and wanting to be happy and not unhappy. And we need others' assistance to be happy. Right? If that is necessary for us to be happy, well, their happiness is just as important as our own. Anyway, so love, compassion, and so forth, I'm sure many of you know this, actually makes sense. But we need to understand that. We need to use the reasonings and then bring it to an emotional level. So that's what we do. We take the different reasonings, and it goes into a lot of detail, but it doesn't matter. It's not a waste of time. So we take all the different reasonings, we analyze, you know, we look at the different phenomena, and then allow it to go deeper. Now, that's the tricky part. That's where it takes some courage, it takes some determination. It's possible to just go for years, just do the debate, and it's just all in your mind, and you clap your hands very elegantly, and the movements look good, and you're very famous, and you're a great debater, but nothing changes. But it is also possible to go into a 3-year retreat, have all the implements right in front of you, a beautiful altar, you know, everything you need, you're very good with the movements, you know, everything is there, but you come out, you're the same person. So these are all different tools, and it's up to us to actually allow this to sink deeper and allow it to change the mind. So analysis, what we're learning is to understand reality better, to get a better understanding of ourselves and other phenomena. This is what debate is all about. And then apply it. To learn about this and not just have it outside of yourself. Oh yes, this is how phenomena exist over there. Oh, karma, this is how it works. This is why this person is suffering, right? Or this is why they're rich or whatever, right? Or what else? Oh, this is changing all the time, those things over there. I mean, that's, again, the scary, like, the mind, that's the mind. Oh, this guy's mind, that's how it works. But no, to bring it to one's own mind, right? One's own. Oh, they're very angry. Look at them. Here you can see the disadvantages of anger because they don't have many friends, right? But then taking it, and that's the scary part. That takes some, right, takes some courage to actually go, so, I've heard all this. What is my mind like from morning to evening? Right? Oh, wow. It's like the HBO is like, it's boring. It's boring. Any of the best kind of movies just playing all day long. They're not as entertaining, actually, as our own mind. There's so much to be found, right? So much going on. Amazing. And without our control, it goes on and on and on. And before we know, we had a major fight with our spouses, our children, our parents, right? Before we know, it's all happened. So, therefore, when we study a debate, for example, we take things apart. We look at them a little closer. And then when we've done that, a little closer and a little closer. And then you try to do the same with your own mind, with your own situation. I'm impermanent. I'm changing moment by moment. How do I exist? What is this I, this sense of an I that controls me all the time, that is ever present somehow, all pervasive, and controls me? Right? Does this actually exist? How bizarre if it doesn't. I mean, you know, that idea, and wow, imagine it doesn't exist, but it's controlled me. The sense that it exists has controlled me all my life. Isn't that kind of amazing? Anyway, so to look at that and to look deeper and to not be scared and to be accepting, also very important. I'm very acceptant of my neighbor's anger. Maybe I'm even a little bit angrier than me, right? I don't have a problem with my neighbor's anger. But my own, that's a little painful to become aware of our own negative qualities and to learn to see it objectively. Okay, it's there. There's good and bad both. In the West in particular, Tibetans don't really have that problem. Tibetans don't have a problem with self-hatred. Surely there are Tibetans, and there are definitely a lot of Tibetan women who have a bit of a kind of like, oh, I can't do this, you know, I can't be as great as the monks, you know, like they're shy and maybe lack confidence. But it's not a self-hatred, and it's not a low self-esteem as such, you know. It's like they're very confident in terms of other things, and they don't hate themselves. And maybe some of you may have heard that when some scientists met with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and they used the word self-hatred, His Holiness was like, what is that? They had to take some time to explain His Holiness what self-hatred was, because His Holiness is not something Tibetans actually suffer from. So we suffer from that in the West. And the more I talk to Westerners, the more I become aware, there's this, ooh, you know, it's like outside of myself. Oh, I'm sorry, I keep doing that. Last time was a glass of water, and today it's this. Okay, so, like, outside of ourselves, we're very good at analyzing everything outside of ourselves, but our own, that's scary. And there's this self-hatred at times, you know? And I'm, yes, oh, it goes like that, great, thank you. This is my first time, actually. I've seen people wear it, but I've never. Okay. Does that make sense? So this kind of self-hatred. And I spend a lot of time every year. I teach a course, students from the Emory University, and they're about 21 years old. So it's that age, you know, of like, when they deal with a lot of they have a lot of problems, doubts, difficulties. Anyway, and so self-hatred has been something I've been fascinated with, and I went through it myself. But then over time, with the study and so forth, I came to see it's just an exaggerated sense of self, unfortunately, because I cannot forgive myself my own failure. My best friend, no problem. She can fail. I'm forgiving of that. In some cases, I may even rejoice, right? It's just how the mind works. Or at least I'm very forgiving. You know, don't worry. It's all right. You know, you can't be perfect. I have great advice for her. But my own failure, boy, that's serious. Yeah? And then I start hating myself, right? I just can't bear it. So, the debate, the kind of analysis, it's a tool where you objectively try to get a bit of a distance and don't allow these emotions to suck you in right away. Look at the emotions, look at your own mind, and see, well, it's not as scary. It's just different states of mind, and they're not who we are. Like our mind, it's our mind. It's not, you know, it's not everything. We have a mind, we have a body, our different minds. So that's not who we are. It's just a part of us. And it's something that changes moment by moment. And if something changes moment by moment, it means it has arisen from causes and conditions. And if I remove the causes and conditions, I can remove that phenomenon because it's just the result of its own causes and conditions. So I need to learn what are the causes and conditions and make changes. Big deal. I can't change. Change is possible. Change, I mean, even modern scientists, they used to say, I forget the exact technical term, you may have to help me with this, but that everything was predetermined. You know, our brain was predetermined. There's, and now they talk about plasticity. Oh, right? The brain can change, and it does all the time, no matter how old we are. That's why I also believe it doesn't matter how old you are. Today is the youngest day of your life. So you want to study? Start today. And it doesn't matter because the mind can always change at all times. And I think sometimes younger people have maybe less difficulty because they study already all the time. They're so used to it. So as you grow a little older, you start working and the study part gets put to the side a little bit. And then the brain is just not that supple. So you have to bring it back to that subtlety. And there are monks, you know, in South India, in Tibet, in the great monasteries. They were farmers, you know, they lived as nomads, and then they're 40, 45 years old, they become monks, and they become geshes. Right? They can do it. Yeah, they have to work a little harder, but, you know, I know someone who started studying at like 43, and he became a geshe at the age of 57. So, I mean, don't let the age idea distract you. That's just an illusion. Thinking that you're too old is the obstacle. It's not the age. It's just thinking you can't do it, right? And I've met so many people and people I teach in Dharamsala, all age groups, and some of the older ones. They're the ones who are really quick and get it, right? And they memorize, and before they know, their mind has changed. The brain has changed. And what has changed is the brain, the mind, and the brain. There are two entities that are separate, but they're very much dependent on one another. I think of it as two poles leaning against one another, right? Of course, the two poles, when you're like that, they don't depend on one another, but our brain and our mind are like that. Whatever happens to the one affects the other. So when our mind changes, the brain changes, and when the brain changes, the mind changes. And it happens mutually at the same time. When one changes, the other does too. So therefore, plasticity. Our mind changes all the time. Your mind will be different. Your brain will be different when you leave this room. There are already new connections you've made. There are already changes. Okay. So don't underestimate any little change. Any little, they're all important because they're very slow changes. That's, again, for us Westerners, I mean, it's the fast food age. You know, we're used to fast here, fast there. The quicker, the better. But Dharma is not like that. It's not fast. It's very slow. Therefore, studying for 16, 17, 20 years, it's nothing. Here it's like, oh, you go to university and you speak to the students and they're like, what? Oh my God. It's almost like you can see them get dizzy. You know, these years of study. But you don't think of it that way. You just enjoy it as it happens. You enjoy it. Every moment is wonderful and beautiful. You don't look ahead. Actually, what I did, I wanted to do it for 2 years. And then I added 2 years. And I added 2 years. So if I had right from the beginning, like 60, oh my God, you know, being German, I would have been like, oh my God, you know, I want it quick, I want it fast. Actually, my story is a great story how not to do it. Because when I first became a nun, I had no idea about Dharma. I'd read one or two books. So I had this plan, this life. Okay, I'll be a meditator. I'll be a great meditator, famous one day. And I'm going to be in this very simple hut, like all the meditators, right? That was my dream. I wanted to be a meditator. That's it. And I took a meditation hut, and I was like, okay, first year, bodhicitta, path of accumulation. It has three subdivisions, so first year, small path of accumulation, medium, right? Okay. And like I looked around my hut, okay, it has to be as simple as possible. Gas? No. The meditators use kerosene. So I got rid of my gas stove. Big mistake. I would wake up with black nostrils every morning because of the kerosene. Anyway, that was me when going through all these hardships, but not doing it correctly. And I got up at 3 in the morning, right? 3, because everyone got up at 3. I went to sleep again at 4. I couldn't do it. So you see, I mean, I was just doing exactly, and then I was like, what am I meditating on? It's like sitting here, and one book. I don't understand this. Oh, this is boring. Next one, right? This is just, I mean, I'm grateful to having done that because I can tell people, don't do it that way. You can learn from my mistakes, right? Okay. And then I realized I need to study. I mean, I really need to know what this is about. And so how, this is how, and maybe some of you have read that interview, then you know, didn't know what happened. It's not really like that in the story, but that's what happened, basically. You know, I thought I was going to be this great meditator, and no, it was just my ego. Right, and then I started studying. So, but to say less about that, the point is that this is a great tool to get a better understanding of the Dharma, this teaching, like debate, this tool of debate. And is this the only way? And I've been thinking and grappling with that. I've been trying to you know, think, how could this be actually done, something that can people do in the West? Because the language and everything, you don't need to necessarily do that. I mean, there must be a different way too, because the Tibetans figured out a way, and the Indians did too. But it wasn't all done the same way in India. I mean, not even the way it's done. They used, in India, do you know how they used to debate? Clapping their fingers, right? They would sit next to one another. You know, it's hot. You don't want to kind of move too much. So, and they'll clap your finger. And then he went to Tibet, and, oh, I mean, you freeze to the ground if you sit for too long. So you want to move a little bit. And so, I guess, I mean, no one said, you know, I have no one telling me that's the case. But it makes sense. You don't want to sit for too long. So one person, you know, moves around, keeps warm, and then they take turns, and then they're sitting there with their kind of cloak. And, yeah, an answer. So this is like all had to be adjusted. And I think, I mean, over time and with more people doing the studies, having done the Tibetan studies but coming from a Western background, it'd be possible to find a way that's more suitable for Westerners, right? Anyway, but to really go back to the study itself has many components, okay? Many components. So that's important to understand. First of all, the courage to analyze yourself. Right? A good debater, a good student, doesn't just, what I said previously, analyze what's out there, but takes it to the self. They're usually the ones who, because then you take your own experience. You take your own experience and you get a much better understanding. Right? With the mind, for example. There's a great meditator. He never got a great title. He wasn't interested. He got some minor kind of geshe thing. It took him 2 weeks. He disappeared in some kind of meditation hut. But his holiness knows about him, and now he's pulling him out. And usually he does the review sessions after his holiness's teachings. He is so famous because of this incredible mind that he has. Why? Because in every moment you can feel he's using this mind. He's using this analytical tool, applying it to his own mind. He's always thinking of situations that have not been discussed in the books, that have not been discussed by the teachers, right? Always doing this. Yeah, and we actually, as Westerners, trained a little bit that way. I find sometimes Westerners do this a lot more than maybe my classmates would do initially because of the background we have, right? So there's a great advantage to the kind of education that you received since you were very little. But anyway, so to keep that mind running, so they do that, applying it to their own mind, and so their minds very quickly change, of course. You look at your own mind and you understand your own anger. If you look at the ugliness of your own anger and you're not scared of it anymore, you start looking at the causes for that anger and you start understanding how they can change them. So there's that part to the study, which is the most important part, to allow it to touch yourself and to look at your own experience. In that way, get greater understanding and a better ability to change. So this is one part, just always taking it onto a personal level, however abstract it may be. That's the challenge too. If it's very, very abstract, it's very difficult to bring it to your own experience. But you need to find ways, and you do eventually. It takes some years to be able to do that, but nonetheless, it's possible. Another part of this training is, of course, you get a better understanding of the scriptures. I mean, when were they written? Can you still read Shakespeare without any explanation? Very difficult, right? The language is different. The way to present something is different. Now, these texts that we study, they're, of course, teachings by the Buddha himself, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Then, of course, the commentaries, Maitreya's Abhisamayalankara, or the Ornament for Clear Realizations. Then there are, of course, Nagarjuna's the texts, like the Fundamental Wisdom, for example. So they were written more than 1,000 years. I mean, almost, 2,000 years. More than 2,000, 2,000 years ago, right? I mean, these are very ancient texts, very different ways of teaching. So when we read this today, we may think, oh, I understood that. No way. Right? So it's very difficult to understand. So it allows us to understand that ancient language. But what's also extremely important is language itself. Because you and I can debate about something for hours, not understanding we actually agree. Why? Because we use the words differently. Right? We use the vocabulary differently. So therefore, the study of debate in Tibetan is called the study of definitions. So first you need to define things. This is how we start. Make sure we define it in the same way, because otherwise we just waste our time. So it was very interesting. As part of my study, we would study also the other traditions, the Kagyu Nyingma Sakya. We did first the basic Lupa studies. We studied the five main fields of study and then spent a semester, not long, it was only brief. We spent about 6 months, a little bit more than a semester, but we spent 6 months in the different monasteries. And we didn't study Tantra. That's a technique. Tantra is a technique. It's not a philosophy. It has a philosophy, but that's based on the sutric system. And they're very advanced people, and that was not what we were going to do. So the main difference, I'm sorry, I keep doing that. The main difference between the four traditions is actually the Tantra. There's definitely like a huge difference in terms of the tantric explanation, the different techniques. But the sutric explanation is very similar. It's almost the same, but the vocabulary is sometimes used differently, which makes it seem as if it was contradictory, right? And especially Westerners who are a lot more outspoken, you know, I encounter Westerners and they ask me, are you Gelugpa? I hate that question. I'm a human being. I don't want to be Gelugpa or Kagyu or something. I'm just a Buddhist, right? I mean, it's like to make this divide, it's very dangerous. Seeing the differences instead of the similarities, very dangerous, right? And then you go, oh, mine is better than yours, right? And that's the next step. It's just different, but it's the same basis. And for me, that was very helpful because I still remember our teacher telling us something and me going, now I show them. It was at Sherabling, the Kagyu Monastery in Bir in North India. So our teacher was explaining us something. And I thought, oh, now I can debate with these monks because I know they got that wrong. The Gelugpa study says this, and I know they got it wrong. I can prove all of those. So I went to the debate. And within 5 minutes, I realized, no, it was just the word was used differently. They were saying exactly the same thing. It seemed contradictory. But I first had to make sure the word was, you know, I had to first understand the word before I was able to understand that. So that's also an important part, understanding that the vocabulary is sometimes used differently. So, I mean, words are just tools. Of course, what lies beyond that, that's what we're trying to get at. And that is true for anything. I mean, come on, try to explain someone the taste of Hershey Kisses. Don't you call them Hershey Kisses, those little things? Yeah, with words. The experience is never the same. The experience is totally beyond that. You cannot put it in words. You can just get as close as possible. And then you need to experience it. The good thing is you don't need words. You can just eat it. Right? I mean, you can have someone explain it for hours, but what's the point? But here we're dealing with things that are not as obvious as, you know, taste, sound, sights. We're dealing with things that are slightly hidden to us. So we need words first. And then we take it towards our own experience, and then the words fall away, and we understand it for what it is. That's the goal. So words are limited, and words can be used in a huge, in a vast way. So we need to understand that we need to first understand the meaning of each word the Buddha was using. So therefore, initially, the study is a lot about defining things. What does it mean to be impermanent? Impermanence is so important. But does it mean to be not eternal? And not last very long? Or does permanent mean to be eternal? Actually, no, it doesn't. You have phenomena that are impermanent and they're eternal. And you have things that are permanent and they're not eternal. They only last for a short time. Right? So we come with our understanding, but before we can really debate it, we need to understand that impermanence just means something that changes moment by moment. It doesn't have to last that long. I mean, this cup, you know, especially the way I talk, a moment later may be gone. So gone is the cup. The impermanent cup is gone. It was impermanent while it was there, but the moment I did that weird movement, it went out of existence. So it's not eternal, but it's impermanent. Yeah? Oh, sorry. No, that's not a good example. You see, I'm getting confused. That's not a good example. No, sorry. I should use a different example. My mind. That's a better example. My mind is always there. It's impermanent, changing moment by moment, but it's always there. Right? I keep making that mistake, saying eternal and impermanent are the same. No. For a lot of people, permanent and eternal are the same. Right? Okay. So, just the lack of this cup being a monkey. The lack of this cup being a monkey, that is permanent. It's just the absence of a quality of being a monkey, of this cup. That's permanent. But the moment I throw off this cup, that quality of the lack of the cup being a monkey is gone. Because you need the cup for having that quality. Right? Or the lack of inherent existence of this cup. Right? It's there right now. This cup does not exist independently, objectively. So the absence of this cup lacking intrinsic existence, inherent existence, that can only exist as long as the cup exists. And when I do that movement, the cup is gone. You have something else, but you don't have the cup anymore. So then the lack of intrinsic existence of that cup, the lack of independent existence, is gone. So you have a permanent quality of this cup, but it's not eternal. Does that make sense? So anyway, this is some of the reasoning that you would use. This is some of the analysis that you use in order to understand phenomena. And we have to first make sure we understand the vocabulary correctly. Okay? So what do we do when we debate? Oh, and then there's something more. You also make your mind more supple. So not only do you get better understanding, you try to make your mind more supple. So that's why our scriptures, especially the debate scriptures, we have, of course, the texts that I described before, like the Buddha's Perfectional Wisdom Sutras that the Buddha gave. Then you have Maitreya's text, Maitreya's commentary on that. You have Nagarjuna's commentary on that. You have all these different commentaries. Now, they're kind of written in an explanatory way. But then, then you have the different debate manuals. So these manuals are written in a way in which you read it once and you go, what are they talking about? It's not written in a straightforward manner. It's like the example, you're just trying to say that, you know, Joe is a plumber. Something famous, Joe Plumber, right? Joe the Plumber. Anyway, Joe the Plumber. Joe is a plumber, he's married, and he's got two kids. So you want to say that, right? In the text. But the debate manuals don't say that. They say Joe is not a doctor. Joe did not train to be a teacher either. Yeah, and so it's like it giving you all these little hints until you read it, and you understand, oh my God, Joe is a plumber. That's what it is, right? I mean, what you get down to is you understand Joe is a plumber, he's got two kids. But that's the way it's presented. So you need to use your mind, you know. And it reminds me very much of these modern-day brain games. Right? What is it? Nintendo and you know, these apps you can see. They're very much like that. They use that part of the brain. I mean, that part of the brain is being trained. That's what you do with debate, too. Some of these nitty-gritty little things, you know, it's like you need to use your brain. It tells you, Joe is not the opposite of not being a plumber. What? Right? Understanding, negations, you know, not. Okay, minus, minus is plus. I mean, for Westerners, that's kind of easy. So, but anyway, you know, count the knots. How many knots? Got three knots. That's not him. You know, four knots, he's a plumber again, right? So, you know, and the debate guy was like, one, two, three, four, like secretly counting so I would not get lost. So basically, that idea of, you know, like, or you say something and something is implied. Right? We get so caught in the words sometimes. So what is the implication to kind of have that distance and see what's implied? So it's all brain games. I keep calling them that. But they're like trainings of the mind. So you see, it's really vast. And it took me years to figure that out. That during, you know, my brother, I have a stepbrother. So on his phone, he has this app, like a Nokia kind of an app. And some of these games, they reminded me of exactly these debate texts. Right? Like using language, and then you had to figure out, are they saying it is that or it's not that? Yeah. So in that way, you make the mind more subtle. Right? You make it more flexible. It's like stretching your muscles, doing funny aerobic exercises until you can do it. And initially it makes you tired. Right? Initially it's exhausting. But it's just as with the mind, as with the body, you need to take a rest then. Right? And Tibetans are good at that. Tibetans don't overstress. Yeah, and I keep telling people, when you study something, you know, you read it once or you read it twice, and then you take a break and you have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. Being here in the U.S., I think that's more coffee. So you drink a cup of coffee and you take a rest. And then when you're ready, you get back to it. You know, you need to rest your mind and then you get back. Yeah, so there's a lot about repetition too and memorizing. So just to put together, I told you a lot of different things, but to just kind of wrap it up again. So the study, the debate is, or this whole analysis is all about understanding the scriptures better, understanding the vocabulary that was used, and then understand, you know, what they actually were trying to tell us, making the mind more supple, and looking at one's own experience to make sure we can actually change our mind as we are studying. That there are changes, that, you know, our anger gets reduced, our attachment gets reduced. We understand when something horrific happens to us, I created the cause of that, right? I created the cause of that, and now it's gone. The same karma I cannot experience again. There's not, you know, no reason to get so depressed and unhappy about it, because there's a good news. There's some good news about bad karma, right? Getting to understand that, understanding the impermanence, nothing is going to last. And I feel very fortunate having done that study, but I also feel very fortunate to have been with Tibetans. That was a great part, and if you have the opportunity to spend time with Tibetans and learn from them, right? I mean, sometimes the language is difficult, but nonetheless, there's something, because the Buddhist ideas are part of their culture, and they practice those ideas. So when I first came to Tibetan Buddhism, and I understand you have many geshes here and you know, monks coming here. So this is wonderful, being in their presence. Why? Because these are, again, funny things that happened to me. When I first came to Dharamsala, I had this yo-yo mind, you know. Something great happened, and I was like, wow! Something wonderful happened. You know, I went to my classmates and they're like, wow, you know what just happened? And they were like, so? And then something horrible happened. I was like, oh my God, oh, something horrible. And they're like, so? So like my teacher would call me, you're like a yo-yo, right? Up and down and up and down. Well, because I had the sense of the permanence of these things. Some solid inherent greatness. Some solid inherent badness, right? And I was like, these Tibetans are like stones. They're like fridges. You know, they're like... I mean, I just got the sense, because there's not this emotional response. Until I understood, no, it's very much their culture, and they say so too, even though they're not educated. They're like, but it doesn't last. You know, it's great in that moment, but the moment the greatness took place, it's already changing into something else. And the bad event, you know, something bad happens, but it's already changing. It's already removing away from the bad event. So they're just kind of like little waves, just like we don't get excited about a wave, you know, a high one, a low one, just waves coming and going and coming and going. And that's our life. It's just a matter of just riding on the waves and just going with the change. And Tibetans are very good at doing that. That's what I learned from the Tibetans. You can see them. They're much more balanced, right? And it's very much part of their culture. And if you ask them to explain it to you, they may not be able to, depending on their education, right? If someone is illiterate, I mean, they may tell you, what's the big deal? Right? What's the big deal? It's nothing. I mean, come on, it could be worse. They keep quoting something that's even worse. Just compare it to something that's worse and be happy that it's not that. It's true. Totally true. Just don't look just at the negative. Look, it could be worse. And then be happy it's not worse. Right? That's what they do. And that's really what I learned from them. And something else I learned was not to be jealous. Jealousy is a 21st century disease. And why? Because it's been conjured up in the West, this kind of competitive thinking, right? This is why a lot of things in the West, yeah, people are successful due to that. But the side effect is that there's a lot of jealousy, right? And that's, again, a bizarre thing, that I'm jealous of those people around me that I'm connected to. So my classmates, you know, my classmates, they were so able to rejoice in someone's success. So like, I usually tell that example of one of my classmates who loved to go to university. He wanted to go to university so badly, and he couldn't go because he didn't even go to high school. And then one of the people he knew from the village he came from got to go to university. And for him, it was like he was going now. It was the same. He was rejoicing. Let's go and have dinner. We have to celebrate. He's going to university. Right? So he was able to rejoice in everyone's success. And the good thing is, they're just happier that way. You don't have to work that hard. You know, you work for your own success, but you don't just rejoice in that. You rejoice in other success, too. Wow. With lots of people, I mean, India, lots of people there, you know, a lot to rejoice in. So there's a lot more rejoicing, right? In your own qualities, your own, you know, success, and then other people's, right? Oh, they just did so well. How wonderful. Isn't that beautiful? I'm so happy for them. Yeah. So that's the opposite of jealousy. And it's just a matter, again, understanding reality. Okay? What we are doing right now, it's a bit like if I decided the right side of my body, that's me. And the left side of my body is not me. So if you say, oh, this is a beautiful arm, I get upset. They just said something, you know, about this. Oh my God, why didn't they say that about my right hand? Right? Why? What's wrong with my right hand, by the way? Right? Actually, they're connected. And I may actually do something, I inject something in my left hand because I'm so jealous. And of course, we get affected by it. You know, it comes back to me. That's karma. Right? We're all connected. So whatever I give out, it comes back to me. So we're all connected. We're one big organism. But it's like, I'm jealous at your success. Jealous at my left hand's success. That's bizarre, right, when you think about it. So doing this study, it helps you to understand that. But, of course, I could see it from my classmates, and I was like, so curious. Initially, I was like, curious. But, it affects you. So you can see these monks with one another. Of course, there's sometimes competitiveness on the debate ground. But what happens on the debate ground stays on the debate ground. Literally, you know, you may be, you know, like competitive and go back and forth and it's all that, but there's no kind of nastiness or jealousy. Like the moment you leave the debate ground, your best buddies, you have a cup of tea and that's it. Right? So there is some competitiveness, but not the nasty part, not the jealousy part. So this is also something, like just learning from the Tibetans, that is still part of their culture. Right? And I don't know whether it's going to change one day, I hope not, but, you know, everything is changing, so the good and the bad, everything. Anyway, all right. So does that kind of help a little bit to give you some sense of what all this is about? That this is just a tool, and we are the ones to use the tool properly, right? If you got a hammer and you don't know how to use it, it's a great tool. It's the best hammer you can get in town, and still it won't be of much use. So that's important. And it may not be the right hammer for you. Again, not the right size, not the right whatever. So to have that objective mind and see, okay, is this something I can, you know, do something with? All right, so talk more about the debate itself. Are there any questions so far? Anything? Any comment? Oh, thank you, okay. But any comments, anything, any doubts, anything? And they're good. And from now on, I want you to switch on a certain part of your mind. I want you to switch on the skeptical mind, right? And this is also something that we had to learn. We had to learn basically to switch on that part of the mind, if you like, or part of the brain, where my teacher, whatever my teacher says, I try to see a fold in it, a logical inconsistency. We're trained that way, right? Right away, try to do this. So this is something that the debate kind of teaches us. And often I would just make a note of that. So be something, a question in my mind. Questions are great. Now, the topic here is like how to remove doubt with this tool of debate. Yes, please.
Oh, okay. You talked about, relaxing, study, mm-hmm. relax, study, relax.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When Geshe-la talks about his time at the monastery and the life of the monks that are studying.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about like 4:30 in the morning until 11:30 at night, and then starting it over. And when I've read biographies, it doesn't sound very relaxed.
Okay.
And so I'm sure it's the attitude, but it's a little confusing as a Westerner to see this intensity and perseverance of effort that would, you know, leave me a wet dish rag in about 24 hours.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Very, very important question. Okay. Now, first of all, the biographies are geared towards Tibetans who are laid back, quite laid back. So sometimes, you know, you want some of these Tibetans who are so laid back, you know, in Tibet, traditionally, things have changed nowadays, but traditionally in Tibet, people didn't have watches, didn't have to get out at a certain time. They were very laid back. So to get them to work, you know, you would tell them stories of the hell rumps, or you may go, you know. And, I mean, these stories, they were geared towards a certain mentality, which I don't even know it exists nowadays, but it still does in some areas, I'm sure. So because they're so laid back, very difficult to stress out a Tibetan. I mean, really, it's much harder than to stress out a Western person. Right? So therefore, it's presented in a different way. So when you read these biographies, you need to read between the lines. It's not like telling you, all right, now, be as busy as you're usually busy with, like, oh my God, it's just going to exactly what you said. No. And when these monks have a very busy schedule, they love what they do. They love what they do. For them, it's like, it's like doing your hobby and doing that all day long. It's not stressful. I mean, look at the debate ground. I don't know whether you've seen them debate. It's fun. And they make sure it's fun. It's not stressful. There's no stress. So you're very, very busy, but you love what you're doing. You don't want to sleep. Why would you want to sleep? There's this incredible text that you really want to... Oh, that's so interesting. So interesting. It's like a great novel, right? You read a great novel. You don't want to put it down. It's like that. You love what you do, but to find the love in it, and to find, you know, that's the art of it. Yeah, I mean, Westerners who come and study in the monasteries and they do too much, they have burnout syndrome. Why? Because they cannot relax. They may be too ambitious. They may be too tied up. They may be too something or other. They can't make it. It's a matter of just finding the joy. I mean, my study was not always joyful because I was only with men. No problem with men. I'm just saying it was just difficult because I was just with monks who stuck together and they didn't want to hang out with a nun. It was lonely at times. But I got so much joy from the study. You know, I was upset. I was unhappy. Oh, get me back to my books. And there's so much in there. They're so rich. So amazing. So you need to find the joy. And then it's effortless. Yeah, it's effortless. So yes, working hard, it's joyous effort. It's not just effort. The word for the one of the perfections, the fourth perfection, yeah, it is not just effort. It is joyous effort. It's enthusiastic effort. So Dharma practice should be fun. Study should be fun. And Tibetans have found a way to make it fun. It's great fun. You don't want to do anything else. Yeah? So you can do it all day long. So this is also something I want to give you. I mean, there's joy in it. That's what you need to connect with this incredible, it's kind of elating, yeah? And we need more joy. The only thing, I mean, we need happiness. We want happiness. And whatever brings us happiness, we can do easily, right? So I want to bring this, kind of show you a little bit about this, or, yeah. Okay, because you need the emotional, and then the emotional is the joy. If it gives you depression, you can't do it. I mean, the classic example is when you meditate. Only meditate for 5 minutes in the beginning, because otherwise you want to puke when you see the debate seat, right? It says that in the scriptures. So therefore, do it for as long as you enjoy it. And the moment it's really wonderful and you love it, leave it. Right? Okay. Anyway, so to go back. Now I lost a little bit where I was just going into. Can someone help me? Just before your question, what was I saying? Yes. Thank you very much. So I need your help. Make sure. This happens to me a lot. You need to follow me closely. You need to remind me of what I was saying. Okay. So the skeptical mind. So please switch that on, all of you. So whatever I say from now on, please, right? And that is based, of course, on what the Buddha said. Whatever I say, check it like you check gold. Even checking the tool to investigate the goal, right? Check it like gold. So please, this is important. All right, so now, about the study itself. I want to give you a little bit of an explanation of how it's structured. Because if you know what it's all about, you find ways to use it. Oh, and I talked about doubt too. Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about doubt. Because it's about removing doubt. So the thing that is important is to understand that not every doubt is bad. I love when I encounter doubt, a certain type of doubt. So the one that arises when you're skeptical, that's a good type of doubt, right? So when you, for example, read something or you listen to a teaching and suddenly you go, wait a minute, that does not make sense. Write it down to make sure you don't forget it, right? That's a good way. I mean, in the debate context, when you debate, you remember, you don't necessarily need to write down because you debate over and over and over and over. And if you debated it 5 times and you really know what your doubt is, you don't need to write it down anymore. But then in your situation here, if you don't hear it over and over, maybe just writing it down is fine. And of course, the monks and nuns who do the studies, they do write things down, right? Keep notes. And then you make it your mission to remove that doubt. You think about it every now and then, you look at it, and don't be frustrated with it. It's great. And what I love the most is trying to figure it out myself. Right? You can also ask a teacher. That's kind of a cheap way out. No, I'm kidding. Of course, it's also helpful. You know, you can ask your teacher about it, but a great way is to try and think and figure it out yourself. So that's what I call a good doubt. That's what I call doubt, and it should always be there. I mean, it's always good if you have questions. When I ask people, I ask after a class, and there are no questions, I get worried. It's like, either, I mean, you know, they really got everything, or they didn't get anything. Because they have no questions, they have no doubts. So we need questions, we need doubts, so they're good. So don't be too worried about removing all the doubts. I mean, highly advanced lamas and geshes, you know, scholars, they still have doubts, they still have questions. Right? There's always something. So that's a good kind of doubt. But there's, of course, the negative kind of doubt, which is one of the afflictions, where you always doubt everything. Oh no, this can't be ever. That can be a huge obstacle. They say, like, it's like it's a two-pointed mind. Is it this or that? Is it this or that? So there's a Tibetan saying, you cannot stitch with a two-pointed needle. Right? You cannot stitch. Because if it's two-pointed, like, how can you get the needle through? So likewise, with a mind that's always like, oh, it's not that, it's not that. When you never can come to a conclusion, that's also a problem, right? So I guess sometimes we have this mind, it comes out of a deep frustration. So you just have to look at where the cause comes from, of like a self-hatred maybe, or an uneasiness, or an unhappiness. Just look a little deeper. Where does the doubt come from? An investigative mind that has joy in trying to understand, or a mind that's kind of always like, oh, negative and depressed, and, you know, it could also be that. So then we need to be able to differentiate between those two types of doubts. One is good, one is a problem. Yeah? So removing doubt through debate, it's not so much about removing all the doubt, it's removing little doubts on the way, right? As a tool, like overcoming, kind of taking it to a different level again and again and again. And that's why we need to, first of all, doubt is good. And also, you need to learn to hear the same teaching again, but listen to it in a certain way that you always get something different out of it. This is also something I learned from the Tibetans. His Holiness gives introductory Buddhist courses a lot in Dharamsala. His Holiness, of course, used to teach longer periods during the Losa time, but due to His Holiness's busy schedule and His Holiness's advanced age, that has basically been cancelled. Like every year it says in the program, it doesn't take place. So now there are shorter events, and the more advanced teachings always take place in the south, like when His Holiness travels in the winter to Varanasi, to Jabungan and Sarah. This is where the advanced teachings take place. But in Dharamsala, where many scholars live, many monks live in the retreats up in the mountains, or people come to visit, His Holiness usually gives introductory teachings. And you basically, when you look at the words, you hear the same words again and again. And there are these great geshes, these great lamas, religiously coming to every teaching. Coming to every teaching. So they have learned to hear the same words, but to listen to it with a different mind. It's again a matter of allowing to touch it, not to get bored with the words, but to allow to feel these words and allow them to touch you where you're at right now. Because you're not the same person who you were 2 weeks ago when you received the same teachings. Things have changed already. Subtle change, but we're just not aware of, that we're not aware of, but it actually is taking place. So the same words can affect you differently. So what does this wholeness just say? All empowerment phenomena that are caused by afflictions and karma are in the nature of suffering. Do I really understand that? Right? Am I still attached to those things? And right, they kind of right away check with your own mind. So that's really important. So don't get bored with the words. You've heard the same thing over and over. Do not try to find new things. Be honest. That's really important to be honest. I don't want the advanced teachings, right? Advanced teachings, when you're not ready for it, it's just a waste of time. The basics, the foundation, you can't hear it enough. Hear that again and again and again. And no, there's no deadline, right? There's no, right, why are we in such a rush? I mean, of course, there is this explanation from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, sentient beings are suffering, we are in a rush. But that's not what we're doing it, honestly. Right? I mean, we're not driven by great love and compassion yet. I mean, some of you may, but, you know, we still have to generate more love and compassion. And so there's like, we only have a sense there's one life. Right? Especially in the West. But honestly, even Tibetans, like people who are born with the idea that there's more than one life, it doesn't feel that way. It feels there's just one life. That's all we know. Right? And so we live our lives as if there was only one life and as we're going to live that forever. Please try to identify that. That's a tricky one. It makes us do ridiculous things that are not helpful. And I include myself. I'm exactly like that. The success in this life, it's not important. The things you cannot take with you, they're not important because you won't be able to take them with you. Whatever name or fame you have, you know, you may be finding a cure to AIDS. In your next life, you don't even know it was you. Right? So name and fame, you can't take them with you. Money, of course, you can't take with you. So the things we've spent so much energy towards, we can't take with us. So we can take what we learn here in this life. And if we'd be in a rush, we're, what is it called? Jekyll of all? Jack of all trades, master of none. That's what we become. We know a little about Tantra. I know a little about this. We know a little about that because we've done all the advanced and everything. But we don't really have a strong foundation. So to start where we are. Right? Start where we are and work until, yeah, and then we move on. And then, well, next life, right? Then we have already a basis and we don't lose this. We take this with us. And then we continue. So even in one lifetime, we do the same. That's fine. Right? If there are many, many lives, why am I in such a rush? Right? In university, this is like joining university and you want to do the whole program, start with your PhD thesis in the first year. Right? It's like that. And it, you end up having a crappy piece of paper there. I mean, you know, it's definitely not a PhD thesis. So that's Dharma practice. You see, we need to consider time a little bit. And now, if we don't believe in past and future lives, okay, this is difficult. And it's difficult. I mean, we all still have doubts. I'm sure we still do. So for those who really have great doubts, I like to think of it, there's a 50% chance there is past and future life. 50% chance. Either there is or there isn't. Right? And living as if there was is a win-win situation. Right? Because if you believe in future lives, and even if they don't exist, doesn't matter. But if you believe in future lives, okay, then you will not go and rob a bank. Because if future lives exist, you will not have more money because you robbed the bank in this lifetime. You may have more money in this lifetime robbing a bank if you're successful and you're a good thief. But you definitely have a problem in the next life or in the future lives. Because the karma works in such a way that generosity leads to, you know, having something in the next life. A moral life leads to happiness. So even there's no future lives, you lived a wonderful, good life. You didn't rob banks. You know, you lived a moral life. And if then there are, well, good luck. I mean, wonderful, wonderful, to your own advantage, because, you know, you can reap the benefits. And likewise, with the study, like, if you start at the beginning, you get a good understanding, and you feel grounded, and you feel really happy with what you're doing, and not like, oh, this Dharma, it's too much, it's just over my head, so confusing. Yeah, why? Because, you know, you start to write a PhD thesis a week after you joined university. Right? So to start where you are and be honest and be okay with being a beginner. I love the beginner topics. I love them more than the advanced topics. And I go over them again and again and again. So if there's future lives, you have a great basis for that, because imprints are left. And if there isn't, well, then it doesn't matter anyway. Right? I mean, you've had joy in what you did and you have a good foundation. Yeah. So anyway, this is also something I always tell Westerners in particular, to start where we are, take time with that, and until you really feel ready to move on, to just start with the basic things. All right, so doubt is good. Rejoice in your doubt, in the kind of doubt that gets you to investigate deeper. But to tell you, okay, so how was this Tibetan way of doing it? Of course, it's not Tibetan. It's come from the Nalanda tradition of Buddhism, right? The Indian Nalanda tradition. So I don't know whether it was exactly the same way, but basically our study, when we studied, consisted of five main topics. Now, they're called the five canonical texts, but that makes it sound as if there were five specific scriptures that we had to study. But no. It's the way it's said, or the five great texts. That's okay. It's called that, but it's actually more the five topics or the five fields of study. Okay? Does anyone know the five fields of study? No, never mind. Okay. So, and then there are some preparatory topics, because you want to debate those five fields of study. Please. All right. Let me tell you that. Okay, I'll tell them to you, so maybe some of you may remember them if you've heard of them. The five topics. Well, basically the way I look at it is that the Buddha gave 84,000 different teachings, of course, so many different teachings, and there's a way of dividing them into three wheels, the three wheels of Dharma. Okay? So there's, again, of course, not surprising, different ways of dividing the three wheels. But one way is just in terms of time. You know, initially the Buddha gave the first wheel of teachings, which includes the wheel of the Four Noble Truths, which were basically the fundamental vehicle, or the Theravada Hinayana teachings, right? The fundamental vehicle teachings. Those were the Four Noble Truths, the 12 things of defendant arising, karma, afflictions, their effects. Of course, emptiness was also included. So these were taught. But basically, yes, the path to liberation from samsara, basically. And then during the second wheel, he gave what is called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Again, in terms of time, there were other sutras included in that, but basically, yes, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which of course the Heart Sutra is one of them. Other sutras, other explanations, other sutras of greater length or even shorter than that. Anyway, so those were the teachings the Buddha gave during that time, so the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And then you have the last wheel where he may have eliminated doubts regarding the first and the second wheel. So the second wheel are Mahayana teachings, actually. So the universal vehicle teachings. First wheel, mainly Hinayana or fundamental vehicle teachings. And then the second, Mahayana or universal vehicle teachings. And also a lot of emphasis on of the Four Noble Truths. This is like a way His Holiness also explains it sometimes. During the first wheel, yes, he taught the Four Noble Truths, but mainly the first two truths, the truth of suffering and the truth of origin. During the second wheel, he taught the Mahayana path, emptiness, most importantly, also the Mahayana path itself, but of the Four Noble Truths, it was the truth of cessation that he taught. if you take up the Four Noble Truths. And during the last wheel, he taught, well, he eliminated doubt between the first and the second wheel, right? Any kind of contradiction that people saw there to be. He also taught, he taught about Buddha nature was, of course, explained already during the second wheel, but more of Buddha nature from the point of view of just being emptiness, emptiness of the mind. And during the last wheel, he taught about Buddha nature as being the mind itself, the mental consciousness itself, right? So during the last wheel, he taught, yes, Buddha nature as in like the mind itself that transforms to become a Buddha. So therefore, of the Four Noble Truths is the path. He taught the path mainly. He eliminated doubts between those first and two wheels, and basically gave the tantric teachings. Of course, not just during the third wheel, but more time was spent to give the more advanced tantric teachings. So you can see this kind of order, starting with the fundamental, the foundation, going into the Mahayana emptiness and so forth, and then of course also tantra during the third wheel. Yeah, so it's very complicated. Of course, 84,000 different teachings. Very difficult to make it easy by having three wheels. But of those three wheels, very much the focus on the study is the second wheel, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. That is the second. So therefore, there is a great scholar, scholar called Jamyen Shepa. Jamyen Shepa. He is the textbook author of Jepun Gomang, Kunkin Jamyen Shepa. So he was a great scholar, and he was great in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. His understanding was great. And apparently someone said to him, well, you're really good with the study of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, but how about your understanding of the Vinaya? How about your understanding of all the other topics? And so then he explained those five topics, right, and I explain them in a moment, they're all based on those Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So they're kind of the most important part of the most important body of teachings, which then takes us to the five topics. The first topic is actually called Perfection of Wisdom, right? Prajna Paramita, or Paroduchimba, or Pasin in Tibetan, right? Okay, that's the first topic, which seems to be saying that's the only topic where you, the only time where you deal with the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. But what you actually deal with this is the hidden meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. That's the first topic. The hidden meaning, which is the path to enlightenment. That's the hidden meaning. So the Buddha had this unique ability when he taught, when he gave the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, where he explicitly taught one thing and implicitly taught something else, or in a hidden fashion, taught something else. Explicitly he taught what in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras? Emptiness. Emptiness he taught explicitly. Implicitly, he taught, what can you do with that emptiness? How do you utilize the emptiness, realize it, and then take the steps on the path to full enlightenment? That was the hidden meaning. It was not directly obvious, right? So when you read the Heart Sutra and you get a commentary on that, it tells you exactly, this is where he taught the path of accumulation, right? It's not obvious from the text, it doesn't say path of accumulation, right? So that's the hidden meaning that people understood this when they had the right kind of mind or developed mind, then they would understand that. So the hidden meaning, path of accumulation and so forth. So this is explained when you study Prajna Paramita, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And because the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras themselves are difficult, taught 2,500 years ago, you use another text that's kind of like a decodifier. Right? It's like a decodifier, which is Maitreya's Abhisamaya Alamkara. Right? That's the text where it actually, Maitreya basically took the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras and filtered out the topics that he felt were most important to study in order to get the hidden meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So that's the Abhisamaya Alamkara. But, unfortunately for us, it was written a long time ago. You need more commentaries, therefore. You need other decodifiers. Yeah. So then there are other texts that are used. There is very famous commentary by Haribhadra, Dewa Tunse, it's called in Tibetan, or I forget the English word now. Dewa Tunse. Commentary clarifying the meaning. Dewa Tunse. I don't know the Sanskrit word, I'm sorry. I can say Abhisamayakara, that's about it. So then of course, the teachings were taken to Tibet. There were other commentaries, too, but then they were taken to Tibet, and new commentaries, and commentaries are being written, you know, even nowadays. We need, again, according to our understanding at this day and age, someone to explain this to us. But it's actually all to understand the hidden meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. That's what you study in the monastic institutions, nunneries, monasteries, for about 6-7 years. Depends. 6-7 years. You study the hidden meaning. So you basically study the path to enlightenment. You study a little about emptiness. You study a little about, but your main focus is understanding the steps to enlightenment. That's the first topic. The Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the Parchin, or Prajnaparamita. Yeah? Then the next 2, 3, 4, depending on the institution, years, you study, what do you study next? So this is the study of Prajnaparamita. Then you study next what? When I say it, everyone will recognize it. Most of you will. Madhyamika. The middle way. Madhyamika, middle way. Well, what do you study really? You study the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, but this time, the explicit meaning. The explicit emptiness. Form is emptiness. Emptiness or form is empty. Emptiness is form. Form is not other than that, right? Very, very obvious, explicitly taught in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, such as the Heart Sutra and other Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Okay. So that's the explicit meaning. You basically learn about emptiness, which is in a beautiful order. You could put the order differently, of course, you could always argue, but that's usually how traditionally in Tibetan monastic institutions, in the Gelugpa system in particular, it's taught. The perfection, the hidden meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, and then the explicit meaning, what is emptiness? So you have all the kind of map. You have the map in front of you, and then you understand what you need to realize, emptiness. And you get an understanding of emptiness. So that's the first about 10 years. But at the same time, while you do those 10 years, you always take time off every year and study another topic, which is pramana, or in other words, logic. It's sometimes called logic in English. So here it's harder to really find a good word in English. It's called pramana. Pramana, the text we study in particular is the Pramanavatika, but you basically study pramana, or you study logic, right? Epistemology. So Dhyanchepa, when he was asked, you know, what did you study? Like, you were best at the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, so what about the study of tsema? Like, in Tibetan is the word of tsema, the study of tsema, of valid cognition, logic, epistemology, pramana. And he said, that is learning the logic that allows us to help to understand the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Right? So, the pramana, the logic, the epistemology, it's kind of like the tool that allows you to understand what is in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Right? Okay. So that is that topic. And so you take 2 months out every year, and the text that we use, okay, so for the 6 years, the 6 years of studies that you do, you use basically the Abhisamya Alamkara, Maitreya's text. Then for the 3 years of the Madhyamika study, which is the second topic, you basically use, well, Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom, but also mainly Chandrakirti's supplement to the middle way. Right. So you use those two texts. Now for the study of logic or epistemology, where you take always 2 months, roughly, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending on the institution, so you take off of every year. So you have 10 years of study, let's say 7 years of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, the hidden meaning, and 3 years of the explicit meaning. You take a specific text written by Dharmakirti, which is the Pramanavatika, which has 4 chapters. And officially, privately, you may study all 4, but officially you study the first and the second chapter. And the first chapter is studied during the 7 year of the implicit meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. That's when you study the first chapter. It's a long chapter. And it takes you, it really shows you the tool. It gives you the tool to really, I mean, you already know how to debate, but there's always room for improvement. So you understand syllogisms in more detail and what types of syllogisms they are, how they can prove one thing, how some syllogisms prove cause and effect. Other syllogisms are more based on the phenomena being of the same nature. So there's a lot to be learned about these different syllogisms. So anyway, that is done during those first 7 years, taking off two months in a year. And then the second chapter, now you've had the tool. So the second chapter is studied at the same time when you study the Madhyamika, those 3 years, or 4 years, three, whatever. So these, the study of the Madhyamika, you take time out, and you study the second chapter now. And now you've had the tool to investigate, and during the second chapter, you try to prove past and future lives. You try to establish past and future life. You establish the continuity of the mind. You establish, enlightenment, basically. Liberation and enlightenment, proving that, the existence of a Buddha, of an Arhat, of an Arya, and of enlightenment. Right? That's what you do during the study of Madhyamika. So you covered three fields of study. The hidden meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the explicit meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, and logic, which is the tool to understand the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Now you're still left with what? Two more topics. Anyone? No? Pardon? Vinaya. Yes. Vinaya, but depending again on the order, but yes, yeah, so Abhidharma and Vinaya. Two topics are actually left, yeah. Abhidharma and Vinaya. So Abhidharma, very difficult. I mean, it actually just means treasury of knowledge. But I mean, that's the word of the, like, that's the translation. So Abhidharma or Mumbadzu, you can. Anyway, so Mumba, yeah. So anyway, but in English, it's often used as it's translated as phenomenology. Phenomenology. So you basically, and this is again, as Jamyan Chepa, when he was asked, you're really good at the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, but you don't know Abhidharma. He says, yes, I studied the phenomena, the different phenomena and categories that are discussed in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Right? That's what he studied. So here we basically use Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, which is a text having 8 chapters, and in those chapters you basically you deal with karma, you deal with just phenomena themselves. How can you divide phenomena in which categories? What are afflictions? What are so just very focused, very specifically take these categories. So in that way, yeah. So you study phenomenology, right? Kind of going through all the phenomena that in a way you have already dealt with, but in a more intense way, maybe, if you like. And then you study the Vinaya. That's the last topic, which is, and as Jamyan Chamber would then say, was this is the moral conduct. Someone who studies those topics should have. Right? So a person who studies the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, this is the moral conduct they should have. So in other words, if you have the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, you should study, you study the hidden meaning, you study the explicit meaning, you study the logic that allows you, the logical tool that allows you to understand the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, you study the phenomenology that is presented in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, and you study the kind of moral conduct that you should abide by when you study the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, which is the Vinaya, as in like the discipline of a monk or a nun, who, like the kind of vows that you have, and in particular what they mean, which vows are more important, which vows you need to definitely keep, and so forth, right? So this is the study of the 5 topics, okay? And also, interestingly, because there are 4 schools of Tibetan, no, not 4 schools of Tibetan Buddhism, 4 philosophical tenet systems, right? The Vaibhashika, the Satantrika, the Chittamatra, and the Madhyamika. Those 4 philosophical schools, right? You may have heard of them. That the Buddha taught, he taught all of these schools, all of these philosophical systems, I should say, or tenet systems, as stepping stones to understanding the deepest, which is the Madhyamika. And when you do the study of the 5 fields, they're all covered. They're all covered. When you study when you do the study of the hidden meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, you basically study one part of the Madhyamika, which is again subdivided. It's subdivided in the Svatantrika and the Prasangika. So there are two Madhyamika systems. You study the lower one as a preparation to the higher one. The epistemology, the part of logic, the logic that you study, is based on the Satantrika, which is the second, the Sautantrika and the Chittamatra, Mind Only and Sutra School, right? For those of you who understand, I mean, it doesn't matter if you don't catch it all now, just that you get a sense, all are covered. During the study of the explicit meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, you study Madhyamika Prasangika. During the study of Abhidharma Kosha, you study Sautantrika and Vaibhashika. And during the study of Vinaya, study Vaibhashika. It's not really the order you would expect, but they're all covered. So you see how this study is actually quite of all-inclusive. I mean, it includes so much. But it basically deals with this very important body of teachings, which are the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Right? Okay. And this we do for such a long time, but there's time. So, therefore, and they're all connected. They're not disconnected. They're all connected. So, in a way, you're looking at the same thing again and again, just from a different perspective. It's really not that, like, otherwise it was just information that is, like, totally different. I mean, oh my God, how could we do it? It's more like getting a bigger picture and going into more details and looking at it from different perspectives and just understanding the interconnectedness of all the topics the Buddha taught. Yeah? So this is really the study that we do. But before we can actually do that, there's some preparatory study. Not surprising, right? Okay, so there are three topics usually done, and there are some other topics that you may do at the side, but there's usually three topics that you study as a preparation for being able to do those five fields of study, right? What are those three? One is dutta, or collected topics. The other one is logic. Logic means study of mind, basically. And then you have tarik, which is a study of science and reasoning. So the first study, collected topics, is basically the total preparatory kind of topic that allows you to debate. It teaches you how to debate, right? Because before we're able to use the tool, we need to, you know, make use of it, understand the logic, understand how it works, and not just understand it, but being able to use it. We need to be able to use it. Okay, so that's the collected topics. Why is it called the collected topics? Well, it takes topics from the pramana, from the epistemology, the logic study, basically mainly from them, but also from some other topics. It takes those, and there's like a little commentary. Each kind of monastic institution has a unique kind of commentary they rely on, but they're not very different. They may be structured differently, but they're very similar. And then there's exactly, you know, like different explanations are given, different kind of ideas are being presented, and then they allow you to have the foundation, to have some fundamental understanding with which you can then investigate whatever you learn. Right? That's collected topics. But then, of course, having that tool, what is study, Buddhist study, all about? It's all about the mind. It's really all about the mind, right? Of course, we like to think of the brain, but Buddhists don't speak much about the brain. I mean, this is why now His Holiness the Dalai Lama is trying to bring science and Buddhism together, because we as Westerners, we know so much about the brain, so little about the mind, right? Whereas the Tibetan scholars, the great masters, they didn't talk about the brain, because the mind changes the brain, so you don't need to talk about that. It's mainly the mind, because that's the thing that moves on. So they don't know much about the brain. So it's basically this idea about the mind. Right? That's most important. So Buddhism, in a way, is a science of the mind. Right? So nowadays, it's important to learn about the brain, and that's what the monks and the nuns do. They learn about it, because then they can present Buddhism in a way in which Westerners understand it better, because of that, the emphasis on the brain. But anyway, it's really, the focus is on the mind. So the second topic, after the collected topics, is the study of the mind. Right? What is the mind? How do you define mind, first of all? Very difficult. Right? It's the one thing we really don't understand. You know, I understand a lot about this cup, but my own mind? Oh, never really looked at that. Right? The one thing we always have with us, we understand very little about. So habituated to looking outwards. So you look at the mind. What is the mind? How do you define it? What are the different types of mind? Of course, the whole study later on will be more details about the mind, but it gives you some kind of like, oh, two categories, first only, oh, then seven, all right, then three, okay, right? It's kind of manageable. Yeah, I mean, of course, there are more categories, and you're aware of that, but at least you get a bit of a sense of what the mind is all about, how it works. And just not just the mind itself, but its objects too. What kind of objects does it have? How does it perceive its object? I mean, it's a very complicated phenomenon. It's always present, so it can do the most amazing things, but they differ. So that's the study of the mind. And then the last of the preparatory, three preparatory topics is the topic of tarik, or science and reasonings, where you, even though you've already learned to debate, you learn more specifically more about the kind of syllogisms there are, you know, how they relate to one another. Like, I'll say more about this. A syllogism basically is saying A is B because it's C, right? A is B because it's C. But, you know, I mean, if you say that, whatever is C has to necessarily be B. You can't just say anything randomly to make it correct. There must be a connection between A, B, and C, right? I can't say an elephant is a cushion because it is a prayer flank. Like, what? I mean, it uses a structure, but those three, whatever I replace A, B, and C with, there has to be a connection, and understanding what that connection has to be. And this I'll speak about more, probably more towards the afternoon, to give you a little bit of a sense. Okay, so you'll learn more about these syllogisms, right, what they are. Okay, so this basically gives, and then that's more, and this study of science and reasoning, it very much connects to the study of logic, of pramana, of epistemology, which you do while you do the 10 years of, like, the study of the explicit and the implicit meaning, implicit and explicit meaning of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. It's just an extension. The study of epistemology is an extension of science and reasoning. Science and reasoning is a preparation for that. Okay? So you get a sense of what we study. I know it's overwhelming, but if you hear this once or twice, or maybe you look at your notes again, in the end it's just eight topics, right? The five major topics and three preparatory topics. And then, of course, you can read about them again, and, you know, with time, you get used to this idea. It's overwhelming, but honestly, when people tell me about sophomore, senior, freshman, you know, it's like, my head still spins. I mean, graduate, undergraduate, I don't understand this, you know. People explain it to me once or twice, junior, senior, whatever, right? I still get confused. So, it's just like that. If you do it, if you grew up here, then it becomes second nature. It's easy. All right. Okay. Now it's 11:35. I don't want to exhaust anyone. I can go on for a long time. It's easy when you talk, right? And I also want to take some questions. So it's dangerous to just tell me, go as long as you want. How about 12? That's good. I'm glad. So I want to take some questions now. Do people get a good sense? Because I also need to get your input, that you get a better understanding of what debate is about. And, of course, we have the whole afternoon. Is there anything where you go, I'd like to hear more about that. I'd like to hear more about that. Because this is a huge topic, and I have relatively little time, and it depends really on the audience, what you would like to hear. So from your side, oh, I'd like to hear more about this, more about this. This would be very helpful. Because honestly, I could go on for a whole week and not cover 10%, right? Yes.
Hi, good morning. So it's kind of sort of off topic, maybe.
Okay.
I'm a little overwhelmed by the vastness of Buddhist knowledge. And want to hear more teachers, and I learn a little bit here and there and that kind of thing. But for me personally, coming from a more academic background and going to college and everything, I'm kind of used to a little bit more linear, progressive path.
Okay. Yes.
I have not yet found that, and I haven't really, and I've read a lot of different books from different people in different lineages, and anyways, you know, people are like the four thoughts, and then the 12 this, and then the 13 this, and the, you know, it's a little bit overwhelming as far as, like, where's the basic, I mean, besides the, you know, the four, what is it, the four thoughts that turn the wheel in the mind.
The three wheels.
You know, and the basic of, you know, this is the truth of suffering. And this.
Right.
Besides that, it's kind of, where do you go from there? As far as, is there a good text maybe that kind of has a good broadness that covers that? Because it just seems so vast that I can't put the pieces in anywhere.
Right.
They just sort of float.
Okay.
All over.
Right. I know exactly what you mean. And honestly, 84,000 different teachings. What do we expect, right? It is a lot. And when the Buddha, after the Buddha's passing away, they start structuring it, you know, and there's so many different ways of structuring it. So, and when you say university, you're used to this kind of structure. That is just illusory. I mean, when you think of everything that's there in science, you know, I mean, people had to find a pattern and had to put something together to give you a sense of structure. And there is a structure then, of course. You start being able to see the forest, right, out of all these trees. So the same is done in Buddhism too. Of course, since it's so vast and since Tibetans spend a lot of time doing the studies, you end up with these eight topics. Trust me, after all that time, I feel I can see the forest, right? It's like after some time. But, of course, it's difficult to do this in the situation you are here. And reading books from different traditions can be even more. I mean, if I did that, I'd be really confused. I mean, we studied the Gelugpa tradition mainly, not in order to exclude the other traditions, but because it's done for someone to understand the teachings of the Buddha. It is done in the Gelugpa system, or just the Kagyu, or just the Sakya. And even when we studied the other traditions, they look very careful at the books we studied as a supplement to our understanding, not so much to go off, you know. So, if you feel comfortable with one tradition, and not to exclude it or anything, but just see this is one technique that is already very it has already everything there. So you may feel comfortable in the Kagyu tradition and focus on that, right? Or you feel comfortable in the Nyingma tradition, focus on that. Just kind of try to see where you kind of feel comfortable. It doesn't mean you have to exclude the other ones, but your focus stays with one. That I would recommend. But then, also understand that all the teachings come down to the Four Noble Truths, right? And maybe you'll see it as such. The Four Noble Truths are the frame. So when you read something, you know, maybe use that as your, you know, like when you clean your room and you put four boxes in the room and there's all this stuff. So one way is put this in this box. Put this in this box. Where does this belong? To this box. This box. This belongs to the path. This has more to do with the cessation, right? Or possibly the object of like the cessation or emptiness, right? That goes into this truth of cessation box. Then there's the truth of suffering. Okay? So our mind right now, okay? Our mind right now, our body right now, the kind of phenomena around us, they go in that box. Then, of course, the afflictions, what are the causes, you know? I mean, okay, mind right now, it goes in both boxes. Of course, you also have the causes, such as the anger, attachment, and so forth, karma. Put that into the box of the origin, yeah? So in that way, I try to structure this a little bit, and this is what His Holiness also stresses. When His Holiness teaches, and as I said, the three wheels, you can say the first two wheels mainly taught the truth of suffering and the truth of origin. The second wheel dealt mainly with the truth of cessation, and the third mainly with the truth of the path. So His Holiness is doing this already, taking the Four Noble Truths. But not just that, the Lam Rim. Everything is included in the Lam Rim. You can then take it a little faster and see where does the Lam Rim, how does it fit into the Lam Rim? So the Lam Rim is not that hard to understand, and I understand that Geshe Gelug is actually teaching the Lam Rim Chemo. Wonderful. What a great opportunity. It's all been translated. I mean, it's there. You have all the material. So you can work with that. And again, look at the teachings. Where do they belong to? And can you exclusively put something in one box and say it does not belong to the other boxes? That's impossible because of the interdependence. Yeah? So there is no solid, independent truth of the path, truth of origin. We like that. We would like that. It's clear-cut. It's not clear-cut. It's impossible, right? It's just the nature of phenomena. It's they're not that clear-cut. We impute this and that on something else, and it's all interconnected. So this we need to become aware of, this clear cut, what we can do in everyday life, maybe with actually putting literally something in this box and not in that, forget it. It doesn't really work that way. But you can make some order, you can get some order, right? Also, of course, there's the great study program at Lama Tsongkhapa, which has found a beautiful way of, you know, putting the teachings together. So you may not be able to go there and participate, but maybe get the material and do it on your own. This would also be a great way of having all the teachings somehow in a structured way. So there now with internet and you know, all this, there's a great way of doing this. And I can totally see how this is difficult. And if I hadn't had the assistance of my teachers and my classmates, I'd be in the same situation, like, you know, allowing me to study in this way. And still it's confusing, right? It's still confusing. One more thing. I'm addressing this more extensively because I'm sure many people feel that way. It's overwhelming kind of information. But one thing I always find, when you read something, you hear something, and it's overwhelmingly confusing, right? Even the teaching. Sometimes, and I have this all the time, nowadays, you know, I read a text, and I'm like, what? Right? I read something. So then I usually think of it as like, read it one more time. Read it another time. You know, take your time with it. Have a cup of tea. Read it again. And then you start having questions. That's the first time I start seeing light, having a question. I can formulate a question. Write down the question. And then you have another question. And then in your mind, you start structuring it. This is what your mind does automatically. The more you deal with it, the more you put things, this goes here, this goes there, this relates to this. And with your questions, you get even more of an order. So this would be just in the situation of a teaching. Okay? So this is a way maybe to get more order. But the main point, it all goes back to the Four Noble Truths and the Lama. Yes, please. Yes, yes. Oh, sorry. Oh, the microphone. Yeah. Sorry, I spent a little longer time on that question, but it's an important question. I've had that question asked so many times, and it's natural in the West. Yeah.
There's no question. There's extensive study that goes on. This is a very high-level question.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably quite stupid, but what you mentioned, debate is a tool,
mm-hmm.
and there's extensive study. What role does debate play as a tool for your studies? And so where does it come into play? I mean, you know, you go and you hear the lectures or you read and you read it again and you read it again and you read it again.
Mm-hmm.
But when do you debate? I mean, what is debate? I'm new to Buddhism, so I'm not familiar with debate court
sure.
or whatever you call it.
Right. Okay. All right. It's basically, as I said, a tool to investigate things. Right? To categorize things, to see how they're related. So in my everyday kind of life when I was studying, we spend more time on the debate ground than in the classroom. We would have an hour and a half of class in the morning, and we had a specific text we always followed, a certain curriculum, a syllabus that we had to follow, and our teacher would go sometimes half a page a day. Right? A page a day. So we just go a little bit, explain the text, right? So we have an idea of the meaning of the words. And then we would go back to our room and prepare for the debate, which basically meant you had to memorize parts of this because you couldn't bring the book with you. Memorization is great. Memorization is great. I teach the Emory students now. I make them memorize now. Lists of things and categories. Anyway, they have tests in memorization, actually. Anyway. But that's not the major part. But you memorize, okay, the bits. So you memorize the definition of impermanent. I give you an example. So you have the definition of impermanent. But then you have other people's definition of impermanent, which are incorrect, right? Which are said to be incorrect. It's kind of implied. Someone says the definition of permanent is impermanent, is something that exists which is not eternal, right? That'd be the definition. But our own definition would be impermanent means a phenomenon which changes moment by moment, or that which changes moment by moment. Now, you take this to the debate ground. You understand the words. Your teachers understood, has explained this to you. You understand the words momentary and all that. So that has been explained to some degree. You've memorized the definitions, so you can actually use them. This is the definition. Someone says, what is the problem with that definition? So you would ask the other person, what is the problem with that definition? Why is that not correct? Kind of assuming it's correct. Or assuming the correct one is incorrect. Right? This is the kind of skeptical. Why is it incorrect? Because sometimes we think we understand, but when someone asks us questions, we go, oh, I haven't thought about that. So you take it apart on the debate ground. Is that really right? Is whatever is momentary necessarily impermanent? Is whatever is impermanent necessarily momentary? It changes moment by moment. How about this cup? Does this change moment by moment? Is it impermanent? What does it mean to change moment by moment? Right? Yeah? So these are like taking it deeper, always kind of taking it deeper. The tool I talk more about in the evening, in the afternoon, there's like a certain type of language you use, which you think it's limiting, but it's actually not. You can do anything with this language. I'll speak more about that. But you get the sense, like, what is the difference between a cup and impermanent? How do they relate to one another? Well, whatever is a cup must be impermanent. Whatever is impermanent doesn't have to be a cup. There's something which is both impermanent and a cup, this cup. There's something which is neither, this clock. So you investigate, right, this way. And you do it all the time, and you go deeper and deeper. So the words that you first thought you understood, you still understand them, but you understand them better, right? You understand them better. So you ask questions. You keep digging deeper, digging deeper. You challenge yourself and the other person. This is how you use it.
How do you come down after something like that? I mean, how do you relax? How do you rest? How can you sleep?
Yeah, there are a lot of stories of people, like there's this story of a monk who came back from the debate ground. My teacher always used to tell us this. He came back from the debate ground and he was so, whoa. So he put the key into the room of his lock and he just stood there the whole night. So it's not the healthiest thing. I mean, you wouldn't want to do that. But, you know, sometimes you don't sleep that much. I mean, you do get, and you need to find a way. I mean, you need to come down. You basically need to do it. I mean, there's times when we debate it so much, all night long, we're like, oh, the pot, is the pot permanent? Is the pot this? Pot is impermanent. The pillar is not impermanent. And like, all night long, I was just going in my mind, yeah, you need to find a way to just say, that's it. What is on the debate ground stays on the And you learn that. It's just a matter of, yeah, you learn that. And to learn to not to be too much in the mind. Also, okay, how does this apply to my own life? Stop investigating, and now allow this, all right, how's my own anger? How do I, and then allow to just let it soak you, right? Oh, impermanence. I'm impermanent. It's changing. Whatever bad situation I am right now, it's not going to last, you know, and just kind of stay with that experience. You need to do that too. Otherwise, it just stays up in the mind. Yes.
Could I please ask you a question, Geshe-la? And by the way, we are so honored to have you.
Thank you.
Could you touch on, I mean, this is a little off the subject, but how you pray? Did you pray also? Or, I mean, how did prayer fit into this, number one? And number two, could you touch on the golden, or talk about at some point, the King of Sutras, the Golden Light Sutra? We are reciting this right now for the long life and good health of Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Why it's so important, and why is it so difficult to comprehend, which it is? I mean, mm-hmm. I think,
mm-hmm.
if you don't mind, or I mean, am I asking something that I would really appreciate that. Thank you.
I need to admit, I was so overwhelmed with the mandala offering because never, ever has anyone offered me a mandala. I forgot the prayers. Usually we start, of course, with prayers in the beginning. I'm sorry, your motivation. I didn't give you the chance. So overwhelmed. Okay, anyway. The prayers. Good question. How do prayers come in there? Okay. That's the first part I wanted to talk about. All right. So, actually, we should have, we totally didn't do it, and that was my, you know, set the motivation, of course. You know, when we sit down, we do the Dharma practice, we should set the motivation to not just do it for entertainment and so forth, but to do it to enhance our mind, not just for our own benefit, but for the benefit of all sentient beings. Of course, taking refuge first, right? Taking refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. I mean, these are the most basic. So, and therefore, as I said, it's only the debate and the study is only one part of it. But there's more to it. We have to do much more than that. So prayers, what are prayers? Okay, there are different types of prayers, actually. They're the type of prayers when you do the refuge and the bodhicitta prayer, right? I take refuge in the Buddha, until I attain enlightenment, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. By the merit I accumulate by practicing the six perfections or listening to a teaching, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now we need to think of the words. Reciting them is only a tool to keep thinking of the words. It's important. It's a little dangerous with saying prayers, especially when you know the prayer by heart. I mean, you can do the dishes and plan your entire day while doing prayers, right? So things like, you know, I mean, I can talk to you and think about the weather. It's ridiculous what our mind can do, yeah? So, by the way, I didn't do that today, but I can. So, and all of you can do that, right? We can do, recite prayers and think of anything but what's... So prayers are actually, the prayer itself is not important. What's important is the meaning behind it. So it's just a tool, a psychological tool, right? It by saying the words, it's very difficult to think, oh my God, my neighbor really sucks. You know, it's like, right? I mean, it's like having these negative thoughts because you think, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And even when that mind comes up, it's like, oh my God, I'm taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Forget the neighbor for the time being, right? At least you can go back. So it's just to keep the mind focused on, I take refuge. Why am I doing this? I take refuge. I open myself up to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to become myself like them in the future. That's what we're doing. It take refuge in one's own future Buddha, right? One's own future Dharma, one's own future Sangha. And, of course, in the external one that allow us to get there. So it's really sincerely, it's kind of like an opening up of the heart. And then, well, there are all these people around me, and they're suffering. So I'm not just doing it for myself, but hopefully one day I can lead sentient beings to the same state. And that already puts your mind, makes your mind very calm. It's just the nature of such, right? It's our mind becomes disrupted when we're aggressive and we're angry with the neighbor and so forth, but it becomes very calm and receptive when you have that state of mind. It becomes more receptive. I mean, try it. A mind that's angry and so forth, you go to the debate, you don't get much out of it. A mind that is kind of soaked with this, I want to do something, I really want to, you're more receptive. Everything else works much better. So when you do prayers, I don't like to recommend people to do a lot of prayers because then you end up just doing thinking about your neighbor, right? A few prayers and doing them well, really thinking about the meaning, making it a meditation. A prayer should be a meditation, right? It should be a type of meditation. So that's what they are for. Many of these sadhanas that people do, initially in the old days, people wouldn't recite them. They would just go through these meditational steps that were described. And then someone wrote down a prayer that allowed the person to actually do the meditation, right? Have the steps in front of you. So then they would memorize it, recite it, but really the main point was to think about the meaning. And nowadays sometimes it's like, well, people just recite it, done for the day. So, you know, you did anything but meditate. So it's important, really, the meaning is most important. So that's the type of prayer that's actually a meditation. But then there are other types of prayers where you pray, okay, this is a kind of meditation, but maybe like you don't take a specific prayer in the text, but you request the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to help you to become a better person, where you kind of, or may I be able, like when I first became a nun, it was very scary. I was quite young, and I heard about nuns disrobing, and I knew I could always disrobe, but I didn't want that, and I had only finished high school. I hadn't done anything more, and so I would have worked the rest of my life at McDonald's. I thought, you know, I'm going to be a waitress one day because I don't have any further education. I've been out of business. Let's say I've been nun for 10 years, and then I come back. It was pretty scary. And so I made very strong prayers. Lama Tsongkhapa Rinpoche was there when I was ordained. It's actually Kirtitsa Tsenpo Rinpoche who ordained me, but Lama Tsongkhapa Rinpoche was part of the people who ordained us. And Rinpoche said, make very strong prayer at the stupa in Bodhgaya. So we were a few nuns, a few monks. Many of you may know Anirita, for example. She was in the group. Or Venerable Rita, Venerable Drime, Venerable... Anyway, so I've seen these names come up again in some of the mandalas and so forth. So we were on this group, and we all went down to the stupa, and we lit lots of butter lights, and we did lots of prostrations that night. May we be able to stay ordained. We did such strong prayers. Really, like, may I be able... So it sets your mind in that direction. It's just psychology. It's like how it puts your mind in that direction. You're already putting it there. You're leaving this imprint and getting you there. That's just the power of the mind. We really underestimate our own mind, right? When we want something, we make prayers, we get a sense maybe someone else did it for us. But there is assistance there. But a lot of that we did ourselves by putting ourselves in that direction. And somehow our group was really scared, right? And we all did all night long. And the next day, we're all still ordained. None in our group, I forget, 10 or 12 people, has given back their vows. I seriously believe it was Lama Tsongkhapa Rinpoche's advice and us doing it that we made this prayer, whatever obstacles arise, maybe be able to, you know, survive, maybe be able to go through it. And something was left there that somehow, you know, however difficult it got, I was just able to kind of pass it. You know, sometimes, you know, I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? You know, I had those moments. But I never wanted to really give up, and so I never did. And I hear this, the other one. So prayer is like that too. You pray for something, you'll be able to do. And it's the power of the mind. Right? So this is how I look at prayer. So like a type of meditation, but they're not contradictory, those two. You put your mind in a certain direction. You want to attain enlightenment. You make prayers for that. You settle very strong seats. So you should pray with that kind of determination, because the stronger you focus and concentrate, the faster you're in that direction. And when obstacles arise, they'll be removed by that. Don't ask me about the physics behind that. I don't know. I'm sure there's a very scientific explanation of that. We just haven't got it yet, how that works, right? The imprints and everything. It's difficult. Does that help a little bit? So that's the prayer. Okay. The sutra. With the sutra, I don't remember the words of the sutra right now, so I cannot tell you what it's about. But it's a word by the Buddha. It's a teaching by the Buddha. And that in itself is said to be very powerful. There's just something about a founding historical Buddha. These words have incredible power. So again, I'm thinking like the power of the mind is such that it can actually change the environment. That's why when you come to Dharamsala, people feel very calm and peaceful. I believe it's the power of the minds of people practicing there, but more importantly, of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, of the Tibetan great practitioners who live up in the mountains, who are not visible. So actually, there's some energy that's created that can change the structure around, the stones, the stuff around us. And I've heard there's been some research on that, how the thought can change the structure of water. It's still H2O, but there's some special energy that's created. There's a movie about that. I think it's called The Power of Water. How the structure still changes. That's why in so many religions, water is being blessed, right? So you can change the structure of water, the things around you. It's the power of words. And if they were spoken by someone like the Buddha, the power still remains, the power of mantras. There's a special power behind them. And again, one day scientists will exactly say how that works. We don't know yet. I mean, there are many things we didn't know 100 years ago, and there's still a lot we will know in 200 years from now. And likewise, maybe one day there's a scientific explanation of how it works. But I'm very convinced of that. That's why you make a prayer. There's gratitude before you offer your food. You change your food to make it healthier. They say this is what you do with your food. You offer it. There's a feeling of gratitude. And so and that food becomes healthier. Your attitude becomes healthier. So the power of prayer, the power of the mind is unbelievable. So therefore, the power of the Buddha's mind, when he gave these teachings are very powerful. So being spoken with the right kind of motivation have a great benefit. And you're all connected to Lama Zopa Rinpoche, right? And Lama Zopa Rinpoche is going to be around for as long as he's needed, for as long as we have the karma for him to be around. So to recite the sutra, it just has this powerful kind of... And when we recite certain sutras and I don't understand the meaning, I don't worry about it. I just try to conjure up this devotion, you know, for my great teachers in Lama Zopa Rinpoche and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who are not separate entities, right? They're not really separate. They're you know, they have the same qualities in a way. I mean, they're very similar. And their enlightened mind, you know, I try to tap into that and just generate that kind of devotion. And that through the power of my mind and other people's mind, that enables the teachers to be around longer. And that's, of course, what we're hoping for. And their health and everything. Yeah, I mean, it's not to say that Lama Zopa Rinpoche got sick because we did something. No, it's a teaching in itself again. You know, it enabled people to remember impermanence, to serve Rinpoche, you know, to understand, well, I can get sick like that. It's a teaching in itself. But anyway, but still to do these prayers, it's very powerful. And not understanding the meaning, it's fine. I mean, in Tibetan, that's very natural because sometimes the writing is not as explicit as English writing. So even though I know a text, when it's recited very fast, it's very difficult to follow the meaning. But then I just, you know, listen to the words and don't try to understand the meaning. But then it's also great to know, oh, there's still something I need to know. I need to learn the sutra one day. So one day, you know, more room to improvement. Great, right? I haven't gotten to the end yet. No, there's so much more to explore. So to look at it that way, I try to look at it that way and just generate a positive motivation, of course, and maybe take the pieces you do understand and maybe reflect on them. Does that help a little bit?
I have good dreams.
There you go. So it has an effect.
It's like your own energy.
Right. I mean, there's so much that's beyond us, and that's fine too. I mean, a lot of the things like Tantra, of course, how mantras really work, how the power of love and compassion, we don't really understand how strong it is. But if we get a little sense of that, that's enough to keep us going. Yes. Oh, sorry, I'm not sure. I think there was someone else before.
No, go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, she's not here? Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
I think it's time to break for lunch, but I was wondering if you could say a little something about what the plans are for this afternoon.
Oh, I'm not sure yet. Okay. No. I'm thinking now with everything. Okay, so maybe I'd like to get an input a little bit before we break up for lunch. What people would like me to do. I mean, I was thinking to explain you the structure of a syllogism, for example. Give you an example of a debate. I mean, it keeps talking about it and the tool and da-da, and you still don't know what it is, right? To introduce to you a little bit this idea of the relationship between phenomena, which is one of the basic things we study. What is the relationship between two things? There's only four ways in which two things can relate to one another, to give you that sense, because it's all about relationship. And speak a little bit about a syllogism, right? What it is, how it relates. And really, honestly, this is the one thing that gives me that confidence. If I can do it, anyone can. Seriously, because I'm just average. I always was. I still am. I'm not more intelligent than anyone else. I just had the circumstances that brought me there. So now I feel it's my job to present this to you and to show you it's anyone can do it, really. So anyway, I wanted to do this in the afternoon to speak about more about this. If there's anything you would like me to, something that you know, or anyone of you feels like, oh, this would help me to get a better understanding, that's helpful. Because everyone has an individually different way of looking at things. So if there's anything you can come up with right now.
Right now?
Yeah.
I'm still kind of absorbed everything this
morning. Yeah.
And there's some things, but I'm not sure.
Right, it's difficult to pinpoint. Well, whenever you remember it, or whenever it becomes clear, just let me know. Anyone else on that in particular? Oh, yes, please. Sorry, I forget to look at.
Could you explain how we can sort of debate ourselves? You know, either or by ourselves.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah. How can you do it on yourself? And you can do that. I do it now, mm-hmm. Right? I can't always like call my ex-classmates and go, "You got a moment?" I mean, the phone is great because I can always talk to my teachers in the South. You know, and I have a question, I can do this. And there's like programs now, WeChat. You know, we do that now. We use WeChat. Never mind. But other than that, yeah. So you can. There's a way. I'll remember that. That's a good way of like doing it yourself on your own while you read something. Okay, trying to remember that.
When should we agree to come back together?
When would you like to come back together? For me, it doesn't make any difference. I can go on all day long. So
I think sometimes we take. Do you want to take like an hour and a half, or to 1:15 or to 1:30? 1:15.
Okay, let's get together. And then 1:15, you're free in this afternoon, right?
Till 4.
Okay, good. All right. Pardon? Well, let's do it together, right? I wonder whether I should do it in English then. I mean, usually it's done in Tibetan. Better in Tibetan? Okay. Okay, great. Let's do this. Okay. So let's go out together. And I try to definitely set the motivation afterwards. Should we do a dedication prayer? I'm sorry for those I've already got up. So I don't want to do it in Tibetan. Why? Because I want you to really think of the words, because you can't do... I mean, and I don't know any... Do you know a prayer in English that you usually do? Could you do that? Could you do a prayer in English? Yeah?
Usually Geshe-la just does it.
The dedication now. Would you mind, because we had this before, so if you could read out the dedication, and everyone just thinks quietly about the meaning and try to really conjure up. So this would be a way to do the prayers, actually, or like all of you do them together. Do Shanti Deva's prayer. Great. Wonderful. Okay. So go ahead. Can you be the Umzi?
Right. Is it all right? I'd like to mention our sponsors today. John Castillo and Louise Miller. The dedication for John Castillo. for the long lives of Geshe Wangmo, Geshe Gelak, and all our other precious teachers. Louise Miller, may all our precious teachers have long lives. May the Buddhist teachings continue to flourish throughout the world. And an anonymous sponsor, may all our precious teachers have long, happy, healthy lives. May all our obstacles be removed for the ordination and Dharma education of beings born in female bodies. May we students of the Dharma increase and deepen our understanding of truth and quickly see the ultimate truth that is liberation. So if you go to our pink page, we'll read Shanti Deva's dedication that we always usually do. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world.